This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning, everyone. Mm-hmm. Lovely to be with you, sit with you, to see your faces. Last week, we visited a friend and we asked a member of our Sangha, we asked him what was alive for him in his practice, and if he had the chance to ask the two of us a question, what would it be? And his question, I thought, was so applicable to all of our lives, all the time, throughout all time in history, and it's two parts. One is, how do we deal with conflict? And two is, in the face of boundlessness, how do we have boundaries? And unsurprisingly, there's a koan that comes to mind.
Your mind.
It did.
Well, she's right. It's very apropos. But I should preface this. This is considered, there's many collections of cases or koans. A koan is a saying or a conversation, or sometimes it's even a question between a teacher and a student. Oftentimes it's more an exchange between two teachers or a teacher and a student. That brings forward some really important element, and it becomes famous. It becomes a public case. And so a koan is a public case. This is from China. This is from the classic Tang Dynasty in China, when Chan, or what we now call Zen, but common, it's still called Chan, was flourishing in China. This was like the golden age of Zen. And so this is from that time. So the teacher Nan Quan, it's case number 9 from the Shoyuroku, or what's called the Book of Serenity. And this is case number 9, or koan number 9. It's called Nan Quan Kills a Cat. And this is a rather famous or notorious even case, because it's very unusual, and it brings up, it's very different from many other cases, and a lot of people have problems with this case, so bear that in mind, you might as well. So there's a slight introduction that's very esoteric, but if you listen closely, it's got a profound meaning. So the introduction is, kick over the ocean and dust flies on the earth. Scatter the clouds with shouts and empty space scatters. Strictly execute the true imperative is to still have a half issue. As for the complete manifestation of the great function, how do you carry it out? So the compiler of this collection is his lead-in to us. He says, how do we meet this koan? So here's the case. One day at Nanquan's is his temple, his monastery in China. One day, at Nanquan's, the eastern and western halls were arguing over a cat. When Nanquan saw this, he took and held up the cat, and said, he said to his assembly, if you can speak, I won't cut it. The group had no reply. Nanquan then cut the cat in two. Nanquan later also brought up this foregoing incident to his senior student. His name was Zhao Zhou, who wasn't there at the time. Brought this up to Zhao Zhou and asked him about this incident. Zhao Zhou immediately took off his sandals and put them on his head and walked away. Nanquan said to the assembly and to him as he was walking away, "If you had been here, you could have saved the cat." So that's our case for today.
So before we get to the exciting part about the cat, I'm always interested in the piece about the monks arguing about the cat. I want to know if you have any ideas about what they might have been arguing about. So there's a cat at a monastery. There's the east and the west. There's some explanation that maybe the monks in the east were the people who worked at the monastery, so that was their practice. And the monks in the west, it might have been the other way around, forgive me. And the monks in the west hall were the ones who were practicing. And so maybe the monks in the west felt a little about the monks in the east. And the monks in the eastern hall may have felt a little funny about, like, that's not real practice, and that's not real practice, about each other. But forgetting about all that for a moment, could I just hear from you what they might have been talking about, this cat? They were arguing about the cat. They don't say exactly what they're arguing about. Any ideas? Please. Whose turn it was to clean the litter box? That seems very likely. Anyone else?
The question of the cat killing the mice.
The question of the cat killing the mice.
Rodent control. Mm-hmm. In the eastern hall or the western hall. Who had the best rodent control mechanism at their disposal? You know, that's what you meant, right?
No, I meant that I meant that it's maybe of concern that we don't kill mice, that we don't take life.
Mm-hmm. That too. You could do both.
Yeah.
Both and. There's some commentary that perhaps they were discussing whether or not the cat had Buddha nature. Anything else come to mind about what they might have been arguing about? Yes.
Both sides claim the cat belongs to them.
Yes, both sides claim the cat belongs to them. And I don't think it really matters a whit what they're arguing about. It's like Nansen comes upon a scene with two kids arguing, going, "Mine, mine, 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 mine." It really doesn't matter what the object is. They're claiming it. And as adults in this world, we don't have to remain children to sometimes have that in the world, go through the world, say, "It's mine, it's mine." And it takes the form often of a hardened view or stance or opinion or idea about how things should be. Mine should be my way. You should not behave like that, because you're not behaving in comport with what I think should be happening right now. And Nansen is like Manjushri, right? He's cutting truth. And he asks the monks to stop and see what they're producing in the world. After all, these are people who are supposed to be Zen students, good Zennies. What are they doing? What are we doing? Arguing about me and mine. He pushes them to say something or act, perhaps, in some way to save the cat. Nansen asks them for an expression of the truth. It's a way of looking at conflict. An expression of the truth in conflict for us would mean to stop for a second, maybe budge our view 1% for just a second, to move 1 degree, to see what the other person that we're calling the other person is expressing. That could be an expression of the truth, to move off our stance and admit there's a bazillion possibilities in every single encounter of this. In fact, it's not this, it's with. This thing we're doing right now is not this with that or this with that. It's withness. How could there be a withoutness? I think Nansen is pointing. So that's the question that our Sangha mate asked. How do we express truth? Not just this truth or that truth, but the withness truth when we're in the point of conflict. How do you do that, Shoho?
I don't know. I do do that, Nansen.
Well, very often without a word, I would say. Without a word. And in fact, notably, Joshu's answer was very direct and without a word. He just acted instantly. And Shoho mentioned to me that this tradition of putting sandals on your head was in ancient China a way of speaking about death. That we're already under the ground, people are walking on us. It's already over, folks. So why are we arguing? It's already over, folks, right now. Every time we're engaged in a conflict, I have this little game I play. Maybe it'll work for you. Maybe you'll hate me for bringing this up. But sometimes when things arise, and I'm otherizing someone else or otherizing myself, which I do as well, I think, am I going to remember this on my deathbed? It's a good game. Because guess what? The answer is always, I'm not going to remember this. There may be something there. The first person in the room, maybe, maybe not the first. I wouldn't go that far. But I would highly suggest that everybody in this room is willing to practice with the idea that you probably won't remember this conflict on your deathbed. Even if it's an old wound that has reappeared and reappears and you have to take care of it, you're not going to remember this instance, this problem, whose cat. Kind of keeps it in perspective. And I think Joshu's very direct answer is that, hey, there's no right and wrong about this. And we're all dying. We're dying every moment. This is a precious opportunity to be with what's happening. Why don't we choose that? We can choose that. So I like this reminder that life is precious. And sometimes in conflict, we think of ourselves in a position or with a view that we think is unbridgeable to the other person's view, like what Shoho and I were just doing. Did you see us moving the bridge? Yeah, we think it's unbridgeable. But all we have to do in a moment of conflict is remember that we're looking through these eyes. We're creating the whole world. We're creating this right now together, bringing it through our eyes. And we all know that everybody else has their own set of eyes, causes and conditions that lead to suffering, conditions that lead to joy. Can we, in the moment of conflict, take a deep breath and admit that his experience and your experience, our experience, is not separate, that we're making it up together? And how great it would be if we could each shift like this all the time. Because what happens in that shifting is you stop making war with yourself. There's no conflict out there. He's not the problem. I'm not the problem. He is the problem.
He's the problem.
We're both the problem that doesn't need to be solved. So there's nothing wrong. There's just something arising. And if we could shift, if we could just commit and agree to shift, to allow that whatever suffering he's experiencing, whatever suffering we're experiencing in this witness, does not belong to him or us. It belongs to everybody. It's all of ours.
We have to acknowledge, though, that that's hard work, that we're actually going against the grain, that our natural inclination is always self-referential. It's always about me. It's always about my story. And we may be wired that way, you know, for our survival, you know, to keep this biological organism, this center of consciousness, which is biologically located, alive as long as it can. So anything we can do to maintain this fiction of separateness, this fiction of self that's separate from another, anything we can do, we may do. But the impetus of, I would say, our spiritual evolution, our the evolution of, I would say, almost like the destiny of awareness itself, of the Buddha way, is to expand that, like you said, and to see not just the self separate as a self-surviving, self-sustaining, svabhava, it's called, own being entity, but a being that is unavoidably involved, totally involved with every other living thing and every other non-thing, and that everything is totally interdependent, dependent on one another. We're dependent on one another. Everything that is not us, everything that is not you, is sustaining you, is actually defining you, because without everything that's not you, there would be no you. So everything that's not you is actually working to make you you. Do you understand? So you can see the mutuality in there. So understanding that as a kind of wisdom, as a kind of big wisdom, is what Nanzen's talking about, and it's the impetus for this big view. It's about you.
Thinking about our friend who asked about how to deal with conflict, I was reflecting that how ample are the opportunities to be hurt or offended or angry. I mean, it's endless. It's relentless how often we go there to be disappointed and offended. And there's really no end to the possibilities of our suffering, but we have a choice. Will we take that up? All of this suffering arises from thinking there's a right way and a wrong way of being with. In other words, going back to our koan, the cat is not the problem. Who has possession of the cat, whether or not it's right or wrong to kill the cat, it's all pretty ambiguous. And the other person is never the problem, as much as I wish it were. It would be so much easier. So our point of view, our reaction, our suffering is really what we have to address. And when we address this suffering, when we take care of this suffering, not in a, I'm a victim, I can't do anything about it, but in an opening way, like, there is that. I'm experiencing that. When you take care of these parts, they become less concrete, less fixed, and somehow compassion just pours in naturally. You don't have to go doing anything. Compassion arrives. Compassion for this one who is suffering. Compassion for your friend who is suffering. And in the moment of conflict, suddenly you're like, oh, this person is hurting. Yeah, they're pointing at me and they're blaming me, but they're suffering. And this, I get goosebumps thinking about it, this is not no longer his problem. It's me. I am in that person's skin, in that body, and sharing this withness. So this is a beginning entry into what do we do in conflict. Even calling it a conflict is kind of interesting, isn't it? We don't have to call it a conflict. We can call it this. Withness is arising something that we're doing together. And now where do we want to go with it?
An opportunity.
It is always an opportunity. And the opportunity is with each person together, with each other. And this is not just me and you. It's me and you and everybody all together. If you stop making war with yourself, you stop making war with other people, and war stops. Imagine that. Imagine, like John Lennon would say. So I think it's important that at all times, including when we're feeling the discomfort of conflict, that we look here and remember who we are, who we are not. We are not separate. We are each other all the time. And if we can respond more peacefully to this here, what's arising between us, it will only make the world a little kinder. It's certainly not going to hurt. So this requires us to reflect on our ideas about what's happening. Who gets the cat? Whether or not we should kill the cat. Whether or not we should let the cat do our killing for us out in the world. But we can examine our views, our different views from different points of view. Although I'm not sure there is any different point of view, but anyway, we can examine what's arising for us because we believe it's a view as one lens. It's just an idea that you have about this situation. And how can every idea in the world not also be in line with reality? How could your view be right if it meant that everybody else's view was wrong? Reality is the whole shebang. So when we cling to right and wrong, good and bad, this and that, self and other, we're stuck. We have to allow everybody here, everybody who shows up here, and everybody who shows up there, to be human and be a cat and be a tree and let us develop the capacity to meet all of those different expressions with compassion. I have to say that in any given day, the voice in my head is assessing basically all the time. I'm assessing. It's mostly directed against me, but it's also directed against you. I promise you. I'm like, it's all about, I judge myself this way first. How do we stop being so hard on ourselves? Well, you can just have some compassion. Everybody here, everybody everywhere is doing their best, given what's happened in their lives, given what's happened before their lives, what's coming in the future. But imagine if everything you did with your body, speech, and mind, you knew was affecting the future. And by the way, it is.
That's called causal conditioning, and that's one of the truths of Buddhism. That everything that we do, or every experience, every event, has causes behind it, and that event, that experience, even that knowing, even that awareness, conditions other things as well. So that mutual causal conditioning runs through not just human activity, but all events in the world. So, you know, the atmosphere affects a rock, you know? I mean, there's all these causal conditions going on. And this truth that Nenzen is trying to get us to meet is really based on a bedrock of Buddhist understanding of this causal conditioning, this interdependence. It's called pratitisampada. It's codependent arising, this interdependence that everything has with everything else, and that there's causal conditions. So like they say, you know, the fluttering of a butterfly affects the atmosphere, and all these things all these things go on in relation to one another. Remembering that truth, or holding that truth, even though we have the impetus for our survival and our own being, remembering those truths, having this broad view, can bring the West Hall and the East Hall into accord, and maybe share the cat.
So if you can recognize that whatever conflict you think is happening out there is your own internal strife, and just take a breath and see your suffering arise. See the other person's suffering arise. Understand that everything is a manifestation of your internal sense of things. And to the extent you cannot be at war with yourself, you do not have to enter war with this person. You do not have to enter war. And, you know, here we are at Compassion Light Temple, Jikoji, Compassion Light Temple. When you open your heart, you don't have to, you know, kiss them on the lips and say, thanks so much for bringing this strife to me and making me see it. But you can have compassion for this one. And compassion is like a light that flows into that darkness. It just flows in. You don't have to do anything. It arrives with you when you take that breath. And so it brings us to this place where I promised I would address, that we would address boundaries and how to behave in this world of boundlessness. And I think that it's not my strong suit, so let me just tell you that. That When our hearts are open, boundaries arrive as well. Healthy boundaries arrive as well. When we recognize that our strength is in our interconnection, in our interdependence, our boundaries can be strong and fully permeable at the same time. You can let everything in and also understand kind of from here what you should do about the cat, so to speak, what you should do about what's right in front of you, so that we can naturally live and act with our deepest awareness right here, right here, right here, right between us, that life is precious and that we really are in this together. There's no other way to be here but together. So may we all continue to return to that awareness in any given moment where we think it's a conflict, and be kind to ourselves and each other. So now it's your turn. Karn.
It's not clear to me why the master had to give them the choice that if nobody speaks, I'm going to kill the cat. Where was he coming from? Why did he put the cat's life on the line?
Well, I know that this koan is a big problem in the whole history of Chan or Zen Buddhism, because many people have problems with actually, you know, the precepts say there's no killing life. So the fact that a Zen master sort of willfully transgressed that precept in order to bring forward this teaching is a big problem for I would say most people that initially hear this.
And what was the essence of the teaching that he was trying to bring forward?
The essence of the teaching?
Yeah, like you said, like this koan shines a light on something. And each koan, the purpose of each koan is to shine the light on some deeper meaning or dharma.
I don't think I said that.
What do you think, Karn?
Didn't you say in the beginning that koans become famous because it's just an interaction that illuminates
a basic?
They become a public case. They become famous. They become well known as a part of the teaching lexicon. Yeah, yeah. But whether shine a light, I don't know. That the teacher had a specific purpose or strategy, you know, or had a preconception or a strategy about this. From what we know about the story, I don't get a sense that it was necessarily.
Wasn't premeditated murder.
Yeah, it was premeditated. It was premeditated murder. No, yeah, no. He decided beforehand, I am going to willfully transgress the precepts to teach these monks something. It felt from what we hear about the story, it was rather spontaneous and the teacher. I mean, if I was a Nankuin, I would have enormous regrets about what I had to do. And actually, if I was the teacher, and I bet he did this too. I mean, he went and he probably went into retreat after that and mourned and made offerings to the spirit of the cat. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm just thinking that if I was him, even if I had to do this to bring forward this teaching, and carried this karma, you know, of killing this cat, I would realize I was carrying an enormous karmic load by taking this life and have to attempt to kind of resolve or purify that experience as much as possible in myself. Mm-hmm. Something like that. Yeah.
Sacrifice for unity? The cat. Sacrifice for unity. A sacrifice to an attempt to unity. Mm-hmm.
There's some commentary.
Don't ask the cat.
There's a couple of commentaries. One is that I think Dogen says he didn't cut him in two, he cut him in one. And the other thing is, you can imagine another scenario where he didn't cut the cat. Okay, you don't have to go there. That
maybe he might have made a gesture just to cut the cat.
Like this, you know. Like,
and some commentators to this koan say, no, he couldn't have cut the cat because a teacher would never have taken life. He just made the gesture of cutting the cat, and then it got embellished into the story as he actually cut the cat. We don't know.
And what could be more dramatic? For those arguing monks, then someone coming along and threatening to kill right in front of them. How much more could it be clear that he's saying, wake up. Wake up. You're going to be dead like this cat. Wake up. You're going to remember this on your deathbed? They probably are.
I still object.
I don't want to rat hole on this, what I was gleaning from this almost felt like a parable about two sides of the same consciousness or entity or awareness or beings arguing over something that shouldn't be divisive, to the point of illustrating that if you're can't agree to get along. I'm almost like I'm back in my childhood with my mom and my brother arguing over something, and she's like, okay, you guys can't have this. You don't get to have it. You know, you're going to argue over it, you don't get to have it. And I got the sense that the message here was, you know, you are arguing over something that is not a possession of either of yours. It's just part of the whole. And the illustration of cutting the cat is about saying, you're not going to have it if you're not unified. That's kind of what I was getting out of it.
Yeah, that's good.
I'm a simple man.
And I like the Eastern and Western, Eastern and Western halls being almost like the two hemispheres, or like the two sides of, like the rational side and the emotional side,
yeah.
You know, are two sides of our natures.
Did you point to me?
The side? No, I did not. You're the rational side. I'm the emotional side. or the before and after duality that we have.
Yeah.
You know, that part of us that's the child that wants to see and the adult. Mm-hmm. You know, that's yeah. There's all these dualities that exist in ourselves, and that's really good insight. Yeah. And sometimes it needs to be abruptly shown that there's a problem here, and if you don't meet it right away,
yeah.
I'm going to shock the hell out of you. And that's what Nanzen did to his whole assembly. They just they must have all fallen backwards and gone into shock, really. Because I mean, it was such an unusual thing. So, and it's possible that that there's a certain times in our life when we need to be when there's so much duality and we're so stuck that we need to be just someone come along and slap us and just shake us and say, "Stop it!" You know.
Yeah.
And that's what Nanzen did to his assembly. And
maybe that's a boundary, right? I saw Marie.
Oh.
Can you speak up, please?
Yes, I got a different take on it as I imagine myself in that scene. I think that the Zen teacher was angry. I'm remembering in some of my various studies about a saint who was an abbess, I believe, and then there was this fighting in between half of the nuns and the other half, and she died. She already had bad health, but she died. Literally, this is true. She did. Mm. And I thought about how painful that must be to have these people that you're bringing up to, have equanimity and compassion, and then they're behaving like this over a cat. And I was wondering if he was angry, and so then all of the monks, there were monks, I think, were afraid to say anything, and that he lost his temper. I agree. And that some of the conflict is between him and all the monks, because they were intimidated by the master, and when they see him angry, you know how it is when someone's angry, the last thing you want to do is say a word, right? So that was what I thought.
And counter to that, the whole issue, the problem arose not from the master himself, but from the conflict of these two groups that were arguing over a cat.
Well, I mean, I guess the way I've seen it is it's all part of the same thing. And that, I guess the other thing is that, is it possible that a Zen teacher can lose his temper?
Oh, of course.
Just want to check on that.
No!
You think Nansen succumbed to the same ailment that the monks were engaged in? Do you think that? Possibly.
Were they arguing over the ownership of the cat? And so the leader just said, well, we'll just cut it in half.
Like Solomon.
Like Solomon. Yeah, exactly. It's a teaching moment there. Because right. You bet everybody in temple was just freaked out when he said, bring me a sword.
Nick.
Siki Harada Roshi presents this corner at the beginning of the book, The Essence of Zen. And
Can you speak up, Nick?
Yeah, the Siki Harada Roshi presents this corner at the beginning of the book, The Essence of Zen. And I think the way he presents it was that the monks were arguing over whether the cat has Buddha nature or not. And he presents the koan and says, okay, consider that you're the monks. Consider that you're Nansen who cuts the cat. Consider that you're the cat. One interpretation could be that, a way I've heard people analyze koans about dogs and cats is that if you're a dog, if you're a cat, it means you. Like you're talking about you. And they're talking about, do you have Buddha nature? And one interpretation of koan is that it wasn't Nansen who cut the cat, but it was the monks who cut the cat by saying, yes, I do have Buddha nature, or no, I don't have Buddha nature, which kind of gets at Nagarjuna's middle way, which is like, the Buddha thought the middle way, and Nagarjuna interpreted it as, if you say that the self exists, I can prove to you that it does not exist. If you say the self does not exist, I can prove to you that it does not exist. And you say that it both exists and doesn't exist, those are four facets of Nagarjuna's middle way, which is to say, like, as soon as, maybe like a, what I interpret as soon as we start to like think about ourselves, like you say, like, I'm this, I'm that, and you kind of arouse the notion of Atman, which is Buddha negated. But it's like as soon as you start to think about yourself, you cut yourself in two. So by trying to like define yourself or think about yourself, you kill yourself because you're not something that you can think about. Your actual reality, which is a found thing in thinking, which is that's one way to think about this poem.
Back row there.
I just wanted to
say that I'm interested in the student that came in. I think you mentioned was the
Jojo,
the most advanced student, and his reaction seemed to be to just walk away. And seeing the conflict, seeing the teacher's decision, and my initial thought of placing the sandals without knowing that this was a traditional kind of symbol of death is that he just humbled himself and then left. And I'm wondering about it. And seeing his teacher, if his teacher transgressed.
If his teacher what?
Transgressed this kind of impassable boundary.
Oh, and like that was a critique upon his own teacher, that his teacher made a mistake. Interesting. I never thought of it that way. I saw him walking away as kind of like, just like a capping or finality upon his statement, you know, when they say he walked away, it was like, I'm done with my statement, rather than the retreat or withdrawal or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And like Nanzen said, putting the in a it was like a funereal tradition to put your feet in kind of in accord with someone who's passed and been buried, to put your shoes on your head. That means I also am subject to death. You know, I also am dying. I'm also facing my death. You know. Meeting my death. I'm in a sense like I am dead with you, you know, to someone who's died. And so Zhao Zhou saying that making that gesture, you know, no words, just making that gesture, you know, this is kind of wordless response that kind of went right to the point of
also the teacher asked for both of the halls to speak on the matter. I think I remember you saying that they were commanded to speak, and the student doesn't speak. Yeah.
So. The whole assembly. No one says anything. No one comes forward.
And then he says, if you were here, the cat would be alive. Yeah. And yet he didn't really speak.
Well, it's, speech is not just, right? You're speaking right now with your hand.
Yes.
You're doing a lot. That says something, right?
He could have a sword in his hand.
Yeah,
you could be. Up, yeah.
You could be. I just want to also respond that it never occurred to me that he was walking out like, I'm walking away from this. You know, like, I think that's really interesting. And I viscerally go, no. No walking away like that. But his walking away was, what else can you say after you acknowledge that we're already dead? What else can be said? It's already over, folks. But I thank you for bringing it up, because now I have to bend around and think about it. So, yes, Jennifer.
I think poem's so expertly written that you can
and there's many versions of them as well.
They're in Chinese, you know, in Chinese characters, and as they get translated to us, unlike Western language, it's broader and open to many interpretations. It's much more fluid than Western language, and more, you know, more open, I would say. Yeah.
Yes, an element of there's conflict earlier, but the conflict avoidance. Neither, no monk spoke of. That could have been about fear from the master. It seems just maybe the boundary, there's a boundary in it, conflict avoidance in there too, because they. Sometimes you gotta, you know, be better. Just one month has said something.
Don't you wish you were there and you were that monk and you jump in and save the cat?
Or just grab
what
the cat.
What would you do? What
grab
would you
the
say?
Cat.
Grab the cat and run. That should be on TV.
I think that would be my thing. I'd tackle old Nanquin and rescue the cat.
Yeah. Me too.
I'm a cat person. So.
That might be means the robbery from the other side. I mean, you're doing the right thing for your own justice, but from other people's eyes, you're secret property.
If there was one person that was neither from the East Temple or the West Temple, or from both the West Temple and the East Temple, maybe that person could save the cat.
I really like what you said. I think the cat could talk.
You know, it'd be interesting to have a modern koan where the cat
does speak,
and there's a reply, you know,
little engagement,
and a long conversation, a long Dharma talk like this, yeah,
meow,
a discussion afterwards,
meow, meow, maybe meow is mine.
Wow, that could go on forever.
Well, unless there's something burning, anything burning? Car burning, because I hear that our beloved Tenso is also burning.
But just as we were discussing it, it came to my mind that because this was a setting where like all these monks were practicing with this really advanced master, they were probably all serious people practicing. And the small issue of a cat became so big, and the master saw it as, you know, the self emerging and concentrating in this cat, and it's just like the mind or the various reason why this conflict is happening. And so he raised up the cat, kind of raising up the self, and it's like, even if one of you speak, I will spare this cat. But because there was such duality, in it, nobody spoke.
Yes.
And so he killed the cat when he killed the self.
Killed the duality.
And then with the Zadlow, he said if we were there, he would save the cat. But he was there. But Zadlow responded by saying that I'm also dead. I'm also just like them. He walked away.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.